I'm Austin Meek. Welcome to this week's edition of Downtown Depot. My guest today is Bill Wetterman, real estate developer. We talk about downtown development, how COVID is changing the retail landscape, and what's the future of all these 1980s-era shopping malls. But first, it's the Small Business Spotlight, presented by American Bank. The swish and swash of a washing machine, the effervescent smell of laundry detergent, the methodical folding of bed linens. All is calm in the interior of Patrick's Dry Cleaners on 7th Street, just two blocks away from the county courthouse, where owner Patrick Margiotta recalls an early love for customer service, dating back to his teenage years in Marlin, making deliveries for Gafford Auto Parts.
I never knew who was going to come out of the house or who was going to roll out from under the car. I never knew. But I learned at a very early age how to engage in conversation with people.
That knack for relationship building has kept Patrick's in business for 18 years, first at its location on Valley Mills near Bosque, and then its downtown location, which it added in 2013. To retain customers, it has to be relational. At least, it has to be more than just a transaction. The industry itself has been upended.
A lot of it is, you know, it's not a suit and tie world anymore.
Fewer people need to look formal in office settings, especially now that Zoom meetings require a top-up professionalism with no regard to what's off-screen. Patrick sensed a coming shift years ago and diversified his offerings when he opened in downtown, even putting forth boot and shoe repair.
It's dry cleaning, laundry, household. We do bedding. We offer a linen service. We're able to do doormats, logo doormats.
The majority of the downtown business comes from commercial customers, servicing napkins and tablecloths from local restaurants. As one can imagine, that side of the business has taken a massive hit during COVID, with dining seating limited to 50% and some establishments shuttering altogether. The Federal Paycheck Protection Program has allowed Patrick to continue paying his staff, but the business itself requires a customer base that simply isn't returning like it used to.
We're not corporately funded or backed. What we do is what comes across the counters. And, you know, it's so important to concentrate on the customers that you have the opportunity to take care of, the customers that access your stores. I mean, that needs to be your focus.
Patrick has kept his eye on the prize. It's all about the customers, which is one reason he's retained the downtown location to normal opening hours, despite the challenging landscape.
There you go. Yeah, showed it out.
I love being downtown. I love driving in the morning and seeing the Alico building, just seeing all, just everything. It has come so far the time we've been here. Sometimes I can't keep up with what all is coming, and that's a good problem.
Patrick's location on 7th and Washington sits in the path of growth. The street in front of his shop has been under construction for months. Catty corner, there's work to be done on the new Magnolia Hotel, a project by Chip and Joanna Gaines that will restore the former Grand Carom Shrine Building.
We've learned how to deal with, the construction part of what needs to be done down here to continue to allow all of downtown to grow. You know, a lot of the stuff that they're doing, it's all underground, and it's time for that stuff to be done. It's probably past time.
The sewer lines in front of Patrick's are past due and being replaced. And there are indeed signs of cracking in the dry cleaning industry itself, but as long as customers keep calling...
Patrick's Dry Cleaners, Jessica speaking. How may I help you?
Patrick's Dry Cleaners will continue providing its service with a healthy dose of friendliness and gratitude.
We're very proud to be a part of the Waco community and being able to pull the open light on every day.
The Small Business Spotlight is presented by American Bank, with three locations in town, including an expanded branch at Franklin and 4th. I'm now joined in studio by Bill Wetterman. Bill is a real estate developer here in Waco. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
What's your Waco history, Bill?
I was born and raised here in Waco, graduated from high school, and left for college, moved away, continued to do some work in business here, and then a year and a half ago moved back.
What was your life like growing up in Waco?
Waco was a great place to live and to grow up in, but a tough place to make a living for a lot of people. you know, most of my high school classmates, you know, as I did at the time, left town just because of the kind of the lack of opportunity. So unless you had a connection or a family business in Waco, it's, you know, the opportunities were elsewhere. So that was kind of unfortunate. But that's changed. I think today there's more and more people that are coming back to Waco like I have, and more of the Baylor students and graduates and other graduates that are coming back to Waco. So that's exciting to see.
Can you fill me in on your time after you left Waco before the last couple of years when you resurfaced?
Studied architecture at Texas Tech and at A&M. Ended up leaving the architectural program at A&M and started a construction company. I did mainly tenant finish out. And at the time in the 80s, you know, regional malls were the thing.
Yeah.
And they were blowing and going. So, you know, building an interior finish out for a store was kind of a specialty in that the larger contractors, these projects were much too small. The home builders that were kind of right-sized weren't used to the materials and methods. I mean, conduit instead of Romex, metal studs instead of, you know, wooden studs. So I ended up doing that for several years and graduated from traveled around the country. Graduated from that to doing shopping center renovations and building shopping centers out of the ground. In fact, I built the CenterPoint Shopping Center here in Waco in 1986. I was 26 years old and thought I was on top of the world. And that just continued to evolve in the development, retail stores, distribution centers, warehouses. You know, the last 10 years I've been involved in a project in Oklahoma City called Chisholm Creek, where I brought Cabela's Top Golf, 15-acre mixed-use development around a 3-acre water feature. And you know, during this time, I was living in Austin and commuting back and forth, which was tough. I had developed the Barron's Loft building 20 years ago and sold it. And last March, purchased it back so that we could do a renovation on it and do a condo conversion.
So this is downtown at 4th and Jackson, is that right?
That one's at 4th and Mary. So with all the activity in downtown and the opportunity, it was just kind of time for me to come back home. I didn't want to be on the road anymore. I didn't want to travel. My family's still here. You know, I've always had an affinity for, you know, older buildings, historic downtown areas. You know, in fact, in the late 80s, early 90s, I actually had several buildings downtown under contract trying to put development deals together, but it was just kind of ahead of the curve. It was too soon for nobody wanted to be the pioneer. You know, I had the Holiday Hammond building under contract. I had the Waco Hardware building, which is now River Center Square, under contract. But it just, the timing wasn't there. You couldn't make it happen. So in the 90s, I came back and started looking again and ended up, the first project was our acquisition was the Barron's building. And then we bought Southwest Drug building, which is now Insurers, and the Imperial Woodworks building, which is the vacant lot next to the silos. And we were going to convert it into an historic restoration and apartments. And unfortunately, when the tenant was moving out, we bought it, leased it back to them so they could build their new facility. One of their subcontractors started a fire and burned it to the ground.
Oh, no.
So that was, again, the timing was kind of premature. I tell people that when we did Barron's, it was like pushing a chain. And in today's time, it's like just holding on. I mean, it's really an exciting time for Waco and downtown.
If you've been in real estate long enough, you've gone through some cycles. I'm sure you yourself have had more and less flush times, whether it's 08 or it's COVID. But the asset classes that people want in real estate, they do seem to fall in and out of vogue. And one that you mentioned earlier is malls. Huge in the 80s, huge in the 90s. We're not seeing as many people go to the malls for their shopping needs today as we've really shifted to e-commerce. What do you see as the future of these spaces where the Richland Fashion Mall, for instance, got maybe 100,000, 200,000 square feet there, and a lot of people are buying stuff on Amazon? Is there a possible better and higher use for these areas that used to be malls, and maybe we can use them for other things?
There is, and just to kind of speak to that, retail is a constant, in a constant state of change. I mean, you go back to about every 10 to 15 years, the retail climate changes. You go back to the 50s, and it was mom and pop, independent, downtown, Main Street. And then in the 60s, it evolved into more suburban as people were moving to the suburbs. In the early 60s, you know, Lake Air Mall, for instance, is a perfect example of one of the first enclosed malls, small albeit, with, you know, had two anchors, two department store anchors. Then from that, it grew into the big regional malls, you know, the half million to million square feet, like Richland Mall. I remember when I was in high school, the Temple Mall was the first regional mall in the area. And then Richland Mall was built, and then the Clean Mall was built. From that, it transitioned into what was called at the time category killers, the big box stores, you know, the pet stores, the office suppliers, the electronic stores. And when that happened, it started putting a lot of the independent retailers out of business. Mm. And it was a step away from the regional. They were called power centers, in fact. So in the 90s, it started evolving from the power centers into the early 2000s into more of the mixed-use centers, where you had a mix of retail and restaurant and office and such. So in the last 10 years, you know, the e-commerce, as you just touched on, and I know that was a kind of a long circle, but I'll get to answer your question. But I think the history is important because retail is in a constant state of change. So 10 years ago, e-commerce really started to become a thing. And then there were a lot of retailers that began opening up strictly online with no sticks and bricks, no brick and mortar stores, you know, untuckit.com. And we can go down through the list. And it grew from 2% of the market share to about 18% of the market share. So then there was kind of a reverse where a lot of these e-commerce stores started opening up because they had a brand identity and they had a product, but now they wanted a storefront. And there's some products that people have to touch and feel, most people. The millennials fall into a category that they don't really have to touch and feel. And with free returns and free freight, they'll get online, they'll buy four items and two sizes and three colors, and they'll all come in and they'll pick out the two or the three that they want and they return the rest. So it's definitely taking market share away from the retailers. But one of the impacts that COVID has just had on us is in the last 3 months, there's people that never shopped online before but ended up having to out of necessity or availability. The grocery store didn't have it. I can go get online and call it and order it. So it's going to be interesting to see how much of that market share jumps over the next 12 months.
Like, will people actually return to the shopping in stores? And does everybody do e-commerce now?
And will people actually return to the shopping? The answer is going to be yes and no. When the stores open back up and the public gets comfortable with shopping, their buyer pool is not going to be as big for certain categories of product as it was before. A lot of the stores had already started downsizing. Even the big box stores, the Best Buys and the big category stores were going from 50,000 footprints to 40,000 footprints to 25,000 square foot footprint. So there's been a lot of space made available from that migration. The answer to the question you originally asked me is what to do with the empty space in the malls. Well, they're being repurposed across the country. Now, in some markets, they'll just be torn down and the land will be redeveloped for its land value. We just saw an example of, you know, the Chili's that was just announced last week that the chicken concept is going to come in and tear the store down and build a new one. There's other malls that have had the opportunity to bring community college or call centers where, you know, the square footage and the parking space they have is a fit. The trend is towards more entertainment, with a lot of the malls and the uses, whether it's a trampoline park or whether it's not so much movie theaters, because they were already a traditional component to the mall. But unfortunately, which I had been a big proponent of, internet proof was kind of my word. If it's internet proof, then there's some security in it. So eating, drinking, entertainment, fun.
Something you can't find a better version of it online.
But COVID just killed that. That was the first to go. I mean, it was the first to go. The movie theaters are still closed. Bars and restaurants are either closed or limited. So that's going to have an impact. What the eventual fallout's going to be, kind of who knows at this point, because nobody knows where the end of this thing's at. If this continues through the summer and through next fall and through next winter, it's going to be devastating. It's certainly had an impact on downtown. It's had an impact on what I'm doing, both from the condo sales to tenants. I had these two projects on Webster on the drawing boards. My tenant pool has shrunk. How much? I don't know. There's not going to be as many. The diversified building was going to be kind of a restaurant entertainment based with more of a marketplace. I mean, look at Pike's Market in Seattle, or pick a marketplace anywhere in the country. It's 60,000 square feet, and we were going to create a boardwalk. The hotel project at Ready Ice is proposed to have 15,000 square feet of retail and another 10,000 square feet that was going to be ballroom conference, but with the other hotels that have announced that are coming, there's probably too much conference space being brought to the market. So we turned our focus to an entertainment venue.
And for listeners who aren't aware, we're talking about on Webster Avenue, very close to the silos, really between 9th Street. Is on one side of 9th is the old Geyser Ice building, and the other side is the diversified building,
correct,
both of which Bill is in the process of redeveloping.
So I'm still bullish on Waco. I mean, obviously there's a pause. Nobody knows how long that pause is going to last. But I feel like Waco's still in somewhat of a bubble and a little more protected and insulated. Not that we're totally protected from most markets, just because of the dynamics of the silos, the network that's rolling out, I-35, Baylor. The COVID impact on office, where more and more people work remote and are going to continue to work remote. The reluctance probably to really get on planes and fly for quite some time. I think Waco's got the opportunity to market itself to some regional and even national companies that can say, we can locate in Waco, great place to live, low cost of living. We can get in our car and in 2.5 hours be wherever we need to be, from Austin to Fort Worth to San Antonio, and cover, the majority by far of the state. And I'm seeing that with my Barron's buyers. Got a contract yesterday from a Baylor graduate who works for one of the major networks in L.A. She's working remotely now. She's buying a condo for a second place to come back home and be close to Baylor and go to the ball games. And she still has family in the state. So Waco's got some unique opportunities that a lot of communities won't have and don't have. So it's exciting.
You're hearing from Bill Wetterman, real estate developer here in Waco and elsewhere. You have a unique perspective as someone who had worked as an architect on the construction side, now on the development side. When you're looking at plans, or you're thinking about how to lay out the space of our diversified building or another one of your projects, what changes in your mind because of COVID? So, we were going to have a big interior space. Now we're going to lift off the roof and have it all be open air. What kinds of conversations are you having internally about that?
Not any major changes. I think there's going to be some impact on the public space and the common areas, and
creating more of it.
Creating
more open air,
where you don't have as many bottlenecks. More open air patios, which we had planned or have planned on the diversified building anyway. I think that from a design perspective, in a workspace environment, there'll be fewer open cubicle, open space offices, and more single offices. I think the mechanical systems are going to get more like UV lighting to disinfect the makeup air. I think those kinds of things from a kind of a technical standpoint is what we'll see. The biggest impact, like as I mentioned a while ago, is I don't know what my tenant pool is going to look like over the next 12 or 18 months. That people that would have been there before that, you know, won't be now because they just, they're no longer expanding or they've gone out of business. But I still think there's a very good opportunity. And we're looking forward to go back and kind of retool our plans and keep pushing it forward.
You predated Magnolia, but your sandbox seems to be within a few blocks of the Silo District there. Are there any other neighborhoods or areas in Waco that are of interest to you as a developer? Like maybe it's the next thing that's coming?
I'm pretty well focused on downtown, and the exciting part of that is the boundaries of what was considered downtown and developable 2 years ago is different than what it was 5 years ago, is different than what it was 10 years ago.
It just keeps expanding.
It just keeps expanding. So, you know, as you're aware, you know, we've crossed over the river now. So, you know, the Elm Street and the Bridge Street and that river frontage, you know, there's some exciting things that can happen over there and will happen. From an economic standpoint, you know, the cost of development there is going to be a little bit less because land cost, land value currently, it'll start catching up. But, pretty much just the downtown area. That's what I find most exciting, where I think the most, you know, opportunity is, at least for what I do.
But you see opportunities on both sides of the river.
Oh,
when you're talking about downtown, you're also talking about the Elm Corridor.
Yeah, absolutely.
The project that you're currently working on, which is the redevelopment there at Jackson and at 4th, and making, I believe, the largest domestic development utilizing shipping containers in the entire U.S. It's been a long time coming. I'm sure there have been some starts and stops with COVID. Recently, you guys were in the news because the TIF board suggested maybe you change the color of these colorful shipping containers that you have. Looks a little bit like Legos. I've always thought it was quite fun. Where's the line for, and I don't want you to get yourself too in hot water here, but the line between a policy and a preference?
I think that line's pretty black and white. I mean, if you look at a zoning ordinance or a building reg or a overlay district requirement, then that's one thing. If you're developing in a historic overlay district and you have a certain color palette and certain architectural style and certain details that you need to comply with to maintain, you know, the historical nature of that's one thing. But when it's not there, then it's totally preference. And that's, you know, the conversations in the position from my perspective is we're talking about preferences. Now, you know, I'm the color selection on the containering was by choice, and it was very well studied in that, you know, we wanted it to be, you know, you're right. It's my understanding this is the largest container project in the country. And I wasn't aware of that at the time when we started, and we didn't have that as an end goal that we were going to accomplish. But it turns out to be currently the facts. But we wanted it to be a fun, vibrant, colorful, eye-catching, memorable wow. And I see it happen practically every day. I can't tell you the numbers of times that I've seen someone pull over, stop, and take pictures or take selfies.
It's invaluable.
You know, so, you know, it's memorable. And it was meant to look like a Lego. There was kind of a, you know, no pun intended, you know, building with Legos, building with containers, just a much larger scale. Now, when we get finished and the signage is up and the landscaping's in and things are detailed, it's not going to look as noisy as it does now or haphazard. But if I neutralize it, it's not going to have the same impact. It's not going to have the same visual impact. It's not going to have the same, you know, memorable impact. You know, we want people that show up at the silos and families, and they can see the colors from the silos, and the kids go, hey, Mom, hey, Dad, we've got to go check that out. Now, if it was all gray, you wouldn't get that response. You just wouldn't. So I wouldn't be doing anything that I thought was going to diminish the value or the attraction of the project. You know, if I thought I was, I wouldn't be doing it. And it's my investment on the line. So I'm hopeful that we're going to be able to come to some sort of agreement. But I think right now the position that's being taken on the other side is strictly preference.
Topics of racial equity have been in the news more recently than ever, certainly in my lifetime. And you hear this term systemic racism. That didn't totally kick in for me until I read about something called the Homeowners Loan Corporation. It was started as part of the New Deal. So from 1933 to 1936, there was something called the HOLC that would give loans to people to buy homes. And this is where the term redlining comes in, because they had these big maps. And if it were a neighborhood that was predominantly people of color, that got redlined and those people were not allowed to buy homes. Therefore, they couldn't start building wealth and really didn't benefit from the post-war prosperity that a lot of folks did. It does seem like zoning and land use can really sort of shift the balance and create more equity for people. So we're looking at maybe even the standard lot size. Let's say your lot has to be 100 feet wide. Well, if you tell a developer, hey, you can actually split that up into four lots that are each 25 feet wide, you can put a $125,000 home there times four rather than one house that you paid for $500,000 and only some people can afford it. Do you think that real estate as an industry has an obligation or an opportunity to address some of these racial inequalities and bring greater prosperity for all people?
Wow.
I'm getting you out here on a burner.
That's a little bit outside my wheelhouse from that standpoint. However, I would have to answer, of course. You know, the zoning and urban planning can have a tremendous impact in driving a market or a neighborhood in one direction or another, either being overly restrictive or being overly lenient. So I think there's a balance there that everybody needs to try to maintain and not let it go too far in one direction or the other.
Bill Wetterman is a seasoned real estate developer here in Waco, answering a lot of my harebrained questions. Bill, thank you so much for your time on Downtown Depot.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Thanks again to Bill Wetterman, Patrick Margiotta of Patrick's Dry Cleaners, American Bank, and you for tuning in to another episode of Downtown Depot here on 103.3 KWBU FM. I'm your host, Austin Meek, and you've been listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business.